Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Welcome to TechTent, your essential guide to all the hottest news and the key trends from the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we roam far and wide looking at what the row at Google over an internal memo tells us about women's role in software development. We'll hear about my digital footprint, and we'll find out about a game that lets you experience psychosis. Joining me is the BBC technology reporter Zoe Kleinman. Hello, Zoe.
Hello.
Good to hear from you again. And my special guest is Stephanie Hare from the technology consultancy Accenture Research. Welcome, Stephanie.
Hi.
Good to have you in the tent too. Here's a flavour of what's in the show.
As we all interact with the internet now, we all have a digital footprint. This is the trail of information we leave behind us.
You can't put it into words. The moment when you look into the eyes of the one who is supposed to reassure you.
All of that coming up. But first this week, the sacking of a Google engineer who wrote a memo arguing that women were innately less suited than men to some software development jobs has caused a crisis at the search company. It cancelled a staff meeting due to be held today over concerns that the employees who spoke out could face harassment. Conservative websites unhappy about the sacking of James Damore have published photos of Google staff said to have backed the diversity policy. Well, let's step back and take a long view of the battle to get women into software jobs. Dame Stephanie Shirley, now in her 80s, was an early software developer who started her own business in the 1960s, employing mainly women as coders. I asked her whether software development had been seen back then as something mainly for men.
Well, believe it or not, it was very much seen as a woman's job. It had come historically out of the clerical section. And think of all those coders during World War II working at Bletchley Park. This was the very beginning of software industry. And now when you look at the imbalance between the genders, it's unbelievable.
And your experience of running a company doing software development and actually positively discriminating in favour of women, what would you say to people who might think that would put you at a disadvantage?
Well, people did at least remember us. They also laughed. Ha, ha, ha. You can't have a woman running a quality organisation. And the sexism was in the 50s and 60s, I started my company in 1962, really was pretty strong. That, you know, I'd be trying to sell a major contract and a junior minister would be trying to pinch my bottom. I mean, it was really tough for women.
Now, attitudes have obviously changed, but women do not appear to be making much progress in the workforce in terms of their representation as software engineers. Why do you think that's happening?
There is this horrendous pay gap as well. The women that are there are undervalued. At the moment, appointments are being made by diversity, and that I find worrying because appointments should be by merit. The concept of information technology now has a very macho aura to it, and some women are just not attracted to that. The lack of girls studying science, technology, engineering and mathematics is decreasing. And yet women are achieving very well in schools and universities, so that it is an unnatural division of labour.
I saw an interesting post this week by a former Google manager saying that too many people have got the wrong idea about software coding. And, you know, lone men working deep into the night on a piece of code, and that actually it is a far more collaborative process. Do you sympathise with that?
Yeah, I think nobody does anything by themselves anymore. It's all a matter of teamwork. But it is solitary. Most creative work is solitary. The really detailed thinking I tend to do late at night when I'm not going to get any interruptions. Working with logic, sometimes binary choices, working very accurately, working with resilience so that all the things that go wrong can be corrected. Now, have I mentioned anything that's anything to do with gender? But these are the sorts of things that are needed for software engineering. And it is such such an attractive way of life. I've had a most wonderful life that the technology has opened for me.
And has it depressed you this week to see this, these claims that, that there are biological reasons that women are not suitable for this?
Rory, I'm often not so much depressed as just disappointed as to how little things have moved on in the 50 years since I started. It is clearly not acceptable for anyone to talk about biological inferiority for any subset of people. So I'm not surprised that there's a lot of fuss, and I think Google has done the right thing by getting rid of the guy.
Dame Stephanie Shirley, who, by the way, called herself Steve when she set up her company in the 1960s because she thought her letters might be answered in a way that they wouldn't be if she was just Stephanie, a real measure of how things have moved on. But Stephanie Hare, special guest from Accenture Research. Yes, we've moved on in terms of the sexism that Stephanie Shirley described there, but women are just not making progress in their representation in technology companies like Google, or are they?
I mean, we're not seeing the representation in terms of numbers that we would like to see, particularly given the amount of time and money companies are spending on diversity programs. That said, I've worked with a lot of really wonderful women who are coders, strategists who have to, you know, it is very much a team effort, and they're just as capable. They're wonderful colleagues. It's, you know, it's a very inspiring field to be in technology. So it's interesting. It's more, what are we doing perhaps to discourage women from studying these subjects, which of course feeds into the pipeline that allows them to then be employed? And also, you know, I didn't study computer science for any of my degrees, but I've worked in technology for years. So understanding that these are skills that you can also pick up on the job if companies are willing to invest in people who are bright and curious, those are the attributes that you want to index for in technology.
Is there something in this idea that Silicon Valley in particular has got this macho idea about what coding is about? It's about staying up all night, eating pizza, being a bit smelly, and being just totally obsessively focused on the job.
I mean, I've done all of those things, so I don't think those things are macho. I think those are all the signs of somebody who is passionate about solving a problem. And also, it's fun. You know, so if you're staying up all night, it's because you're cracking a problem or you're advancing an idea that's new. And, you know, of course women love to do that as much as men.
Let's bring in Zoe Kleiman. Zoe, how do you think Google has handled this whole issue this week?
I think Google couldn't possibly have got it right, whatever they'd done, because emotions were just running so high, weren't they? They fired the engineer and they said he was in breach of their code of conduct, which he was. They said that, you know, their policy is absolutely one of diversity and inclusivity and that it's vital to the business. But of course, that has also attracted criticism, because another one of Google's principles is free speech. And a lot of people have come back and said, well, hang on, you know, you've just shut this down. You're not even letting this guy have a viewpoint. It might not be the popular viewpoint, but it's still something that, you know, in a culture of free speech, people should be able to articulate and spark debate on. So they've been criticised in some corners for that as well.
Well, that one is going to run and run, a continuing issue right across Silicon Valley and right across the technology industry. Let's have a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Zoe. Zoe, Snap, the company behind Snapchat, looks like it's found an amazing way of making investors' money disappear, not even after 24 hours.
It's a clever firm, isn't it? Snapshares took a hit recently after the social media platform reported more than $400 million in quarterly losses. A short while ago, they were trading at just under $12, which is down from the $17 at its IPO in March. And that's because although revenue was up, so were expenses. And to add to its woes, the firm only added 7 million new users in the last quarter. But chief executive Ian Spiegel said that he and co-founder Robert Murphy were not going to sell any of their own shares this year. So I think they're trying to suggest that things are going to be fine and that, you know, they're worth holding on to.
They're trying to reassure people, but yes, exactly. The kind of market's really turned against Snap. The battle for online video hotting up. What is Facebook Watch?
So if you're logged onto Facebook in the US, you will soon start to see a Watch tab. And if you click on that, you'll find a range of shows, including ones that have been made by Facebook itself. You'll also be able to leave comments and connect with friends, which sounds rather familiar, doesn't it? It's the sort of YouTube, Netflix kind of model. And the shows at first are going to focus on factual entertainment, cookery, fitness and travel-themed programmes, Facebook says. And while we're speaking about online video, Disney's announced that it is going to pull all of its content from Netflix in 2019 with a view to creating its own streaming platform. It had already moved its kids' content away from Netflix a little while ago.
Let's get a brief word from Stephanie Hare. Do you think, this battle for online video is hotting up. Is Facebook going to be the place for it?
I mean, they're certainly going to take it seriously. That's a big contender to go up against.
Yeah, they've got the money. Mind you, so has Amazon and so has Netflix these days. And so you found a way to win at fantasy football. Does it involve AI by any chance?
Rory, how did you guess?
Everything involves AI.
It certainly does. Southampton University is inviting football fans to take on its AI fantasy football manager, which it's calling Squad Guru, as the Premier League football season gets underway this week. Apparently, it's well-trained on data going back 5 years, which it then uses to forecast the results of matches and also the performance of individual players. It didn't take part last season, but the teams it has produced would have placed it in the top 1% of the fantasy football league, the researchers claim. So it's definitely one to pit yourself against if you're feeling very ambitious.
Yeah, we'll be watching their performance like
I'm terrible at it, so I'm certainly not going to get involved.
You're listening to Tech 10 on the BBC World Service with Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, how your digital footprints could put you in danger. Now, 3 years ago, a British games firm, Ninja Theory, set off on an ambitious mission to give people an authentic experience of what it's like to feel the effects of psychosis. In developing their new title, Hellblade, they decided to consult a Cambridge University neuroscientist, Paul Fletcher. I asked him why he agreed to get involved.
For a long time, I've been really interested in the experience of playing computer games because I think they offer quite an interesting perspective to a participant because you're not a sort of passive observer, but you're actively participating in it. The stuff that's been put in there goes back to papers from the 1960s that I drew their attention to, you know, first-person accounts of what people felt was happening to their perceptions and their psychological processes. And so to see those represented in such a compelling way is in itself, I think, very valuable.
Well, Hellblade is now out. It's been out there for a couple of days. And I asked Tamim Antoniadis, creative director of Ninja Theory, what his team had been trying to achieve.
We were a team of about 20 people on Hellblade, which is small by gaming standards. We wanted to do something that was more like an independent movie, something that was creative and risky and tackled something serious. And that's not that usual in games. But once we decided we wanted to do that, it wasn't just Paul that we brought on board. We also brought on a professor of psychology called Charles Fernyhough from Durham University, who's an expert on voice hearing. But more importantly, we brought on service users from Recovery College East in Cambridge who have lived experience of visions and voice hearing. And so they gave us the very personal human story, and we worked with them for the course of 2 years. I think it's not dissimilar to a movie where, I mean, my favourite director is probably Kubrick, the research he put into his movies. And if you're trying to tackle a serious subject like mental illness, there's a lot of pitfalls, and we just had to make sure that we understood the subject as best we could.
You can't put it into words. The moment when you look into the eyes of the one who is supposed to reassure you, make you feel safe.
And what do you think it will give to those who play it that they wouldn't get from a game that hadn't had that kind of research behind it?
People are already responding to the game, and people are quite overwhelmed, actually. They're overwhelmed by, first, the voice-hearing aspects of it, and then the visions and the delusions, and then, over time, by the suffering that it causes the main protagonist, Senua.
Come here.
Killed him. Her world changed that day when the Northman took him from her.
And this is no accident. People told us how they hear voices. They can locate them in space, so they might be talking to them right behind their ear or on the other side of a door. And when we heard that, we got this binaural microphone, which is a funny little microphone that has two rubber ears on either end. But basically, it records as the human brain or head hears sound. And we got actors in to simulate voices around this microphone. And then we played it back to people who actually hear voices and asked for their feedback until they said, this is how we hear. And when you hear that in person, it's incredibly unnerving and unsettling.
Their gods can see into your mind. They will use this power to destroy you.
They won't stop me. I can still feel him.
Whatever's left of him, they will never let him go.
So really, this is a game that's more than a game. It's got a mission to educate people about mental illness.
I think it will educate people about aspects of mental illness. I mean, it's very difficult to condense a person's experience into something which is essentially a piece of entertainment. But this game does a lot of things that is not about having fun. It's about going on a vision quest like the main protagonist Senua does. And it's a harrowing and brutal one. And it's pretty uncompromising.
I'll find you, my love. I promise.
Tamim Antoniadis, co-creator of Hellblade. Now, what kind of personal information do we leave lying around on the internet as we roam the web and use social media? And does that leave us open to all sorts of threats, from identity theft to physical harassment? A few weeks ago, a security company offered to study my digital footprint to see how much of my data I'd put out there. Digital Shadows produced a chunky 30-page report with some quite worrying conclusions, as I found when I went to talk to their chief technology officer, James Chappell.
Well, I think as we all interact with the internet now, we all have a digital footprint. This is the trail of information we leave behind us as we interact with the internet. So we talk about digital footprint is what you intended to put online, but a digital shadow is what you didn't intend to put online and might be relevant to your security or safety.
And you found quite a lot of personal information, which I'm not particularly worried about, but tell me about that.
You're actually fairly typical of the clients that we work with. So things like your home address, some of the relationships with either professional or personal relationships are obvious from your digital footprint. There's things like the email addresses you use. If someone was hostile towards you, those things are used by them to socially engineer their way into positions that would potentially threaten you or those around you.
Now, you found, for instance, obviously you found my family, but you found some workplace colleagues that I'm connected with. Why might that be of use to somebody with evil intent?
It's quite common for people to impersonate people that you have professional relationships with an intent of duping you into doing something that's in their interests. So this could be sending an email pretending to be them, and there are some protections you can put in place to stop that from happening. Or it could be more at a social level, sort of outside work, someone registers an account pretending to be one of your colleagues and then sort of contacts you at work. You take it on trust that they are who they say they are, but actually they're not.
I was actually duped by another company which pretended to be Jack, who's recording this interview, and sent me an email, and I was fooled. So I am vulnerable on that front. That's my sort of personal information, which is out there. I'm quite prolific, let's say, on social media, so that's my own fault. What worried me a lot more was what you found in terms of passwords.
So, yeah, so this is quite interesting. We now see websites routinely breached online. So every week there's a new collection of websites that have been attacked. And quite often the usernames and passwords are the things that get leaked online. What we're seeing a lot of at the moment is attackers are using this published information to break into things like email accounts And once you've got someone's email account, you can sort of take over their lives digitally. So it's very, very important that you use different passwords on different websites. It's very, very important that you use passwords that are sort of complex and difficult for attackers to guess.
I'm relieved to see that the passwords that you've listed here are old ones that I have changed. But that's going to be pretty worrying for a lot of people. A lot of people won't have changed their passwords for years.
No, I think that's exactly right. So it is unfortunate that still most people use the same passwords for a range of different websites. And that is unfortunately a big weakness in a lot of people's defences.
James Chappell of Digital Shadows. Special guest Stephanie Hare of Accenture Research. I know you've worked a lot in the data field in the past. Did you find that scary? Should I be worried about how much I've put out there?
Yes, you should be really worried. We should all be really worried. And one of the things that's very interesting is I think a lot of people feel very powerless about all of this because all of these companies know so much about us, but we don't even know what it is that they know about us. We don't have that 360-degree holistic view of what is knowable. So we know that the EU has the General Data Protection Regulation coming into effect next year, and the United Kingdom, despite Brexit, is going to be incorporating that law. So you will have, as a UK citizen, I know we're on the World Service, it's global, a UK citizen or an EU citizen, the ability to request that companies delete your data. And of course, this makes a really interesting problem for companies, which will have to know what data they should have about you and what they need to get rid of.
That's all very well when, you know, you're approaching companies. I've put my data out there and it's in the hands of people who won't, frankly, accede to my request to delete it. Scammers and so on. I suppose I ought to be a bit more careful. Should we all be a bit more careful about what we let people know? Or isn't it inevitable, for instance, that one's home address will end up out there?
Well, there's some interesting strategies about this. So if you try to take yourself offline, that in itself is an anomaly. It's a sort of odd pattern. So we can kind of look to nature and think, is there more comfort in hiding as sort of a member of the herd, like zebras, you know? So you having a bunch of stuff on your social media, if you're just posting pictures about cats and food, like millions of other people, that's not particularly interesting. It's more like the kind of data. So putting pictures of your children online, probably not a good idea.
Aren't we, though, getting more, younger people in particular, getting more sophisticated about their social media? I mean, we were talking about Snapchat earlier. Actually, Snapchat is, in many ways, a much more private sort of network than Facebook, for example.
Yes, it's true that people who use Facebook and Twitter are seen by younger people as being sort of old farts. But I guess what I would just caution is that it's cheaper for companies to keep your data than to delete it. So just be very mindful that everything you're putting on the web is most likely being kept.
And briefly, are you pretty confident about your own profile online? We won't find much about you if we aren't searching.
I mean, I'm really boring, so God help the person who wants to look. But no, I'm not confident. This stuff keeps me up at night.
It keeps us all up at night. I was pretty scared when I saw passwords, luckily old passwords, popping up on the dark net in that research. We're out of time. Thanks to my colleague Zoe Kleiman. Read all of her stories at bbc.com/technology. Thanks to my special guest Stephanie Hare from Accenture Research. Don't forget our Facebook page, BBC Technology, and join us again in the tech tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.